Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
So I introduced myself by saying I spent 20 years growing up, 20 years messed up, and 20 years locked up, but I never gave up. And so I've been out now over 8 years, and so I've moved from working in a prison with inmates to getting out, being contracted by the courts and counties to work with people whose lives are in chaos.
Well, that was a pretty intriguing introduction, wouldn't you say? That was Lyle Wilds, and he is a brain coach. Hello, this is Judy. Thank you so much for listening to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Lyle has a pretty interesting understanding of our brain and how it works in relationship to behavior. So you'll hear him talk about that we have to change the brain in order to change our behavior. And he's going to help us understand more about that, what that looks like, how to do that as we go along. Lyle's story is really interesting, how he became a brain coach, where that education came from. He's going to tell us and really paint some great pictures for us in story and example. It is quite a journey. I have had the opportunity to work with Lyle. I don't remember exactly the first time I met him. I can't remember if I happened upon him on the internet and then ran into him at a conference, which I think actually what happened. And then I started to do some work with the domestic abuse intervention program, and poof, there he was again, doing training. So I've had great opportunities to hear various stories throughout the parts of his life that he called out in the beginning, as well as what he's gone on to do and work on after that. And it's pretty fascinating. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear his story. And of course, there's a lot we don't cover, but who knows, with some of the research he's involved in, we may hear from him again futuristically. You may have noticed this is a two-parter. I've divided our conversation up, and so there will be a little bit of a cliffhanger for you. Hang in there. Next week, all will be revealed. And after the interview, we'll have a fun little thing that we're doing that I'll share with you then. Enjoy the interview. I always love the opportunities that I have to sit down or chat with Lyle. It's always inspiring, thought-provoking, curious. I hope you enjoy it as well. I'm here with Lyle Wilds, who is a brain coach, which is not something we typically see on our on our career options. So that is your given self title for all the work that you've put in?
It is. Okay. I am a brain coach.
Yes.
And so the reason I'm a brain coach is because we now know that the brain is the organ of behavior. And if we don't like the behavior, we have to change the brain. And in order to change the brain, we have to coach it. And so you coach the brain either externally as a teacher to a class or internally through self-talk.
Okay. Self-talk. It's a pretty powerful tool that most of us aren't necessarily aware of, right?
Yep. They estimate that we talk 40% of the time to a brain outside of ourselves, like inside of your skull. I'm talking to your brain now.
Uh-huh.
And 60% of the time, we're talking inside of our brains. So we're yakking 24/7. And our brain protects what we talk about.
Our brain protects what we talk about. So explain that a little bit.
Okay, so if you take a young girl, like 7, 8, 9 years old, or even a young boy,
mm-hmm.
and they want to learn to ride a bicycle, they'll be really excited about it. And if we do a spinal tap on their spinal fluid, we'll find that the spinal fluid that the brain is marinating in when the child is really happy has a different chemistry than it just does normally. And so they've decided that the new chemistry that the brain has for children that are happy softens the brain so that the dendrites can grow faster so you can learn to ride a bicycle in a day. But if you go back to your normal brain spinal fluid and you want to quit smoking, but you really don't want to, you're just telling the people that you have to. So your brain knows that you don't want to, but it also knows that you're saying you want to, and it knows what's really true. And so when you say that you want to quit smoking, but you tell us you don't, the spinal fluid changes in your brain and it hardens the dendrites so that they won't purge. And so my conclusion is that nobody will ever change until they're excited about it. And then that will soften the dendrites so that you can pull them back and create new ones and go around them so you have the new behavior.
Interesting. So that really, that a lot in the process of when we think about learning and we think about our passions, we talk about do what we're passionate about.
Yep.
That leads to the whole concept of not only why we succeed or why we can push ourselves and how we gather that information, but it's just all a better, it's healthy for us, or it helps us learn and do and process, like all from that excitement.
So if you were just to picture, the human brain takes in, I don't know, they estimate about 11 million bits of data every minute, but it only processes about 40 pieces of data. So it knows what most of the data is repeat. So if you were to picture a guy climbing the wall and you wanted to take a video recording of it, the camera doesn't change the wall. It just changed the movement of the guy on the wall. So it does. It gets in all the data, but it only needs to change a little bit of it. So when you think of the brain taking in a lot of data, it really just wants to simplify things. So does he like it? Does he like it? Does he not like it? Does she like it? Does she not like it? And it responds the way in which you secretly hold that between you and your brain. And so when I say you and your brain, I'm really talking about the sense of self that you now are probably talking to as I'm talking to you about your sense of self. And so it could be really complicated because the sense of self that you're talking to is what has to build a healthy relationship with the brain. And if those two aren't connected up in a friendly way, it runs on autopilot.
I think about that when I think about people and trying to change their health habits and their eating habits and the, you know, the concept of I want to eat healthier, right, is one concept, but then something sparks them and they get some idea of excitement around eating better or eating differently, and then that's what they're able to run with. And it's kind of that, okay, you were ready, you got excited, and you're able to now you're in the space of wanting to want to, but you're like saying those are totally different processes in our brain.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So there's also the belief that the cells of your body eavesdrops to the thoughts of your brain and changes accordingly. And so you could say, oh, that's not true. That's really far out there. But if you were to think about falling off of a top of a silo and you were visualizing it and you were scared of heights, you would get a sense of fear in your body and you're not on a silo.
Right.
So the brain doesn't know the difference between reality and fantasy. And I really would say that since the brains are so different, it isn't the food you eat, it's what you think about the food that you eat.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's... we should sit down and do a whole podcast about how to do that properly. You could change the world there.
Yeah.
So as a brain coach,
mm-hmm.
tell me what that means and how do you work with people and the work that you do?
Well, first of all, the kind of work that I do is having an individual meet with me who wants to identify the operation of the brain. So we might say, if I ask you, you know, who's a friend that you have? Give me the name of just a friend, first name.
Jeff.
Okay, so Jeff. So I could ask you, so what's Jeff like? What's the texture of Jeff? And you might tell me a certain texture to him. And then I would go, that's the kind of guy he is. Or I might go, well, I'd like to meet him. But you're telling me the texture of him. So when I meet with people, I have a process which involves 38 core values or word values. And by the process I use of separating them out until you get down to your final five core values, that will tell me the texture of your life. And then there's another process that we use to find out what did you value when you violated your core values. So let's say that I'm really compassionate, and then I also have a violator of wanting to be right. And so I really don't care about you anymore. I care more about being right than about your feelings. And so you have values, and then you have value violators, and I can identify the chaos in your life based on the seriousness of the violators. And that's all neurological.
So what, when you're working with somebody, what then do they do or do you do with that information? Like, how does that help them?
Okay, so first of all, we just have to get some terminology. So I just want to tell you a quick story. Swiss Watch had like 87% of the business at one time, and they had like 75,000 employees. So they were really selling watches and doing a really good job. And so somebody in the corporation asked the research department to identify and develop the watch of the 21st century. So they went out and they studied it, and they came back, and they came back with a watch that had a stone in it, a battery, and it was digital. And so that's going to be the watch for the 21st century. But the Swiss Watch Company said, no. The board of directors said, no. Swiss watches have gears, springs, and they're really accurate, and that's what we're all about. So put that on the shelf and now make this watch better. So they left it on the shelf for like 2 years, and then they decided to take it to a watch conference in Texas. And they took it to Texas to sell at a watch conference, but they never patented or copyrighted it. And so who bought it but Texas Instruments and Seiko? And they took that watch, and they turned the world upside down in terms of watches. And Swiss Watch went down to like 17% of the watch business and had to lay off 50,000 employees. The reason they had to lay off 50,000 employees is because they didn't see the future coming, and they wanted to stick with gears and springs. So my point is that when you're asking me questions about a brain coach, if I wanted to talk to you about a watch that was a Seiko digital rock-based watch, we cannot use any of the language of the gear spring vocabulary.
Okay.
Because if we use springs and gears, you'll go back to the old thinking, and you won't be able to get the thinking of the stone digital battery watch.
Okay, right.
So when I'm talking, and I find that when I talk about brain coaching, and I talk about the brain, and I talk about what people do, I would say that people exercise their brains, and they discipline their brains. They put their brains on a diet, not so it gets smaller or skinnier, but so that it thinks clearer, better, and more efficiently. And so when you ask me, what does a person do? First, we identify what the problem is. Why do I have so much chaos? And then when you understand why you have so much chaos, then you say, what do I need to do? And that is, you need to decrease, de-emphasize, stop the neurological landscape that causes you to want to be right all the time, and increase the compassion by practicing it day after day after day. If you want to be a really good basketball player, you practice. If you want to be a really kind person, you practice. If you want to be a bully, you practice. And either one, you can get down really well.
So helping people identify and then sending them forward with, okay, here's the core values that you have. So go forth into the universe and be those core values, basically.
Yep. Okay. So you have to build a relationship with your brain. And when you build a healthy relationship with your brain, then you can build a healthy relationship with other brains, because you know how other brains work, and you don't want to trigger them so that they don't like you. And so you want to build a good relationship with those other brains, and then we can all get something done together. It's really interesting because, you know, if you took 10 people in a room and you set all 10 brains out of their skull on a table, you wouldn't know who's who. Mm-hmm. Same size, same color, same kind of blood vessels, everything. The only thing that differentiates those brains is the activity inside of them. And the activity inside of them is geared to manipulate and move the body. And so if the brain just sat on the table and we fed it oxygen and blood and all that kind of stuff, it couldn't do a thing. But you set it in a skull and wire it to all of the appendages of the body, it can either hug you or hit you in the face with its fist.
Wow. It is kind of a wild thing to think about. Like, it's just a floppy disk operating system in there with no way to express itself.
Yep. So one other thing about it is that, so when corporations identify their core values, they are never conflictual. So you might have teamwork, respect, honesty. So a corporation wants the kind of core values that when everyone lives that way, it's innovative, it's creative, it's safe, it's all those things. But when you're raised in a chaotic house, the brain doesn't care if core values are conflictual. And so if you were to learn that being right or having to control or having everything orderly, but then on the other hand, you want to have security and safety and you want to be compassionate, and those, when those clash, you will have chaos in your life. There's no question you'll have chaos in your life. But what's interesting about it is that the brain doesn't identify chaos as bad. It doesn't identify any of its neurological activity as good or bad. So if the brain has no way of knowing fantasy from truth, good from bad, and so if it's not interested in that because it can't be taken time to make judgmental decisions, mm-hmm. It is a operating efficient mechanism to get what you want, what it wants, by moving its body without you objecting.
That is interesting to think of the efficiency coupled with the what you really want in a moment. What it wants in a moment.
So I always say what it wants, because if you haven't brought your sense of self up and you haven't monitored what your brain's doing. So one of the things that I really ask people to do, and that is to spend at least 10 minutes in the morning quiet and just sit down, and I call it quieting the brain. Some people call it mindfulness, meditation, whatever. But I just want you to quiet your brain down. And the reason I say quiet it down, because if you don't quiet it down, it doesn't stop running. It just goes, because it's a problem solver. And it doesn't care, you know, whether it solves it the right way or the wrong way for us, but it's a problem solver. And when you do that, and you're sitting there with attention to what your brain's doing, you start to see what it's focused on. You start to see what it thinks is important. So you might sit there and think about sex. You might sit there and think about security. You might sit there, is this guy going to hurt me? Am I going to fail at this test? So the brain is always trying to figure out what it needs to do next. And you need to listen to what it's trying to figure out. And then if you don't want it to do that, then you can interrupt it.
So that looks like, just to give a vision of this, literally sitting down in a chair, being present and awake, but just paying attention to what's going on and noticing that, taking that information in as this is where my mind is going when I let it go.
Right. So when you're sitting there and you're sitting in a chair or you're sitting on the floor, however you want to do it, if you're sitting there and a thought comes into your head, rather than analyzing what it is, just let it fly through your mind like a bird, and it doesn't leave a trail. But many of us, when we get a thought, we hook it up to like a train, and we have 1,000 cars, and we just, oh, I can't believe I've been thinking about that. So when a thought comes, let it go, watch it, let it fade away, don't hook up to it, and then wait and see what the next one is.
Hmm. And if you are in a space where you're noticing those things and you're like, okay, I'm not happy with this. Like, this is not where I want to be putting my focus. What's your next step?
Well, that is an interesting question, because a lot of people will ask, well, what should I do? But I want you to just really hear me when I say I would never ask the question, what should I do? I always ask people, what kind of a person do you want to be at this moment, every moment of your life? What kind of a person do you want to be at that way? You want to be the hotshot, the star, the status person? Do you want to be present and peaceful and people are safe around you? Whatever kind of person you want to be, that will determine what you're going to do. And that will determine what you're going to have. And then when you get down to that and you understand what you're going to have, you have to ask yourself, is that enough? Will that satisfy me? So if I'm going to be in a relationship with someone and I want to be this kind of a man in that relationship, so I'll do the kinds of things that that man would do, and then I'm going to get a response back from that person, I have to ask if that's enough. Do I expect more from her or him? Do I expect more and I'm not getting it? But yet that's the kind of person I want to be.
So I want to, and I want to continue on this track if you have a direction you want to go. I also would love, because you've said a lot, right?
Yes.
And I would love to back up and ask you the question of, so how did you get here? How did you get to the brain coach? Let's talk about your history, because it's pretty phenomenal.
So I introduced myself by saying I spent 20 years growing up, 20 years messed up, and 20 years locked up. But I never gave up. And so I've been out now over 8 years. And so I've moved from working in a prison with inmates to getting out, being contracted by the courts and counties to work with people whose lives are in chaos. And so the more chaos that your life is, the more likely you are to go to prison. The less chaos in your life, the less likely you are to go to prison. And so I was born and raised in a little farm by Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. The town is called Lime Ridge, Wisconsin. It's about 50 people. And so I was raised on a farm. My dad was a construction worker. He never worked for anybody. He just worked for himself. And I don't know how he did it. I just never really talked to him about it. But he was an artist when it comes to bricks and mortar and blocks and stone. So he could make a fireplace that people would just be spellbound over. So he did a lot of fireplaces for the really wealthy people. Like one fireplace would be one-sided, another fireplace might be in two walls, another fireplace, you could see it from three rooms. And so it'd be like a triangular fireplace, and wow, it would go up and go out, just one stack at the top. And so people really liked them. And so my dad was really strong about learning how to develop a skill. And so if he said, if you have a skill, you'll never be hungry. And so he never really focused much on, Dad dropped out of school when he was in sixth grade. So he never really focused on us reading. He would always focus on how well we could lay a cement, how well we could lay a wall, or how well we could cut hay, or, you know, whatever those things were, drive a tractor. But my mom, she was a school teacher, but she never got to teach. And she was always the yin and yang of Dad, you know, trying to get us to read more. And she was a history buff. She really liked history. So if you told her that later on in my life when I was dating someone, she'd tell me who they were related to, who all was the history of that person, you know, and why I should or should not be in that relationship. And so I lived that way. And when I was in high school, I was better known for my athletic abilities than my academic skills. And so I was a really good wrestler. I played football. I was in track. I was a pole vaulter. And as a wrestler, I was undefeated. And as I was undefeated, Dad was really proud of me. So my whole life as an 18-year-old was sports. And I'll just tell you this story about how it affected me. And so I was a wrestler. My coach was Ron Bentley. I went to Weston High School, which is out in the country. It was Casanova and Lime Ridge came together, it was two counties, Washington and Sauk. So it was Weston, that's what it was called. And so when I would wrestle, my coach would always say to me, because he was always liked the way I wrestled, he'd always say to me, so Lyle, you're 10-0, go out there and beat this guy. You're 15-0, go out there and pin him. And so I would do it. I just thought that's what I was supposed to do, you know. And I got to the state championship my junior year, and I came up across a kid that was a wrestler from Coleman, Wisconsin, which had a lot of good wrestlers, did have a lot of good wrestlers. So we were both standing on the edges of our corners of our mat before we went out on the mat, and coach came up to me and he said to me, okay, Lyle, he said, this kid's from Coleman, Wisconsin, a lot of good wrestlers up there, he said, but you're from Weston. He said, and I want you to go out there, and you're both 22-0, and I want you to go out there and do the best you can. And I'll never forget how I felt when he told me that. So I knew that my coach didn't think I could beat this kid, and so I was ahead till the last 25 seconds, and the last 25 seconds, I threw the match, I let him reverse me. It just seemed like that's what he was supposed to do. And when the match was over, when the referee raised this young boy's hand, I wondered how surprised he was that he won, because I wasn't surprised that I lost. Mm. And I never will forget how I felt about that, because I still believe that I could have been the state champion. But my coach just said that to me. So then when I was 18 and I was graduating, I had taken classes like shorthand and typing, and I just liked the curiousness of shorthand, how you could write with shorthand so fast. So a bank from Reesburg, Wisconsin sent a representative to the Weston High School, and they were looking for a banker that they could have for a branch. And they weren't looking for a woman, they were looking for a young man, and they took me. And so I went to the bank, and my dad wanted me to stay with him, you know, and work the construction business in the farm. And mom wanted me to go to college, so I just wanted to go to the bank, not because I wanted to be a banker, but because I would have money coming in, I'd have a job, I'd be making money. And I really want to emphasize that, because I didn't know what the core values of the banks were. I didn't even know what a banker's life was like. I just knew that I was going to go to work in a bank. And so as I started to do that, the core values and the lifestyle of a young boy on a farm, you know, work hard, be tan, have a six-pack, you know, be rough and rugged. And I walk into bank, and I'm driving a 57 Ford convertible, and they don't say anything about my car. I had cruiser skirts on it, which were those long skirts, and I had Lori, was the girlfriend that I was going with, on her name on it. And so I worked there for about 6 months, and I could really see that I was unable to go from the lifestyle of a young boy and a construction worker to a banker. And that period that I was in between there, I do call in between. Mm-hmm. And so being in between, and how you process that, determines the quality of your life and the quality of your new life. And so my dad was sabotaging my new life, because he would say to me, look at your hands, they're starting to look like a sissy. You come home, you smell like the perfume and the women that worked there. And the bank never gave me any positive feedback. They were always telling me, slow down, don't work so hard. You know, all of the kinds of things that gave me a notice that I was honorable and that I was important. Mm-hmm. And so one day they told me to take the checks back. Now, this is back in the 60s, so people would write checks and we'd walk them back. They didn't have machines where they'd just be rejected.
Oh, right.
And so I'd walk them back to the grocery store and to the bars and all the places people would write bad checks. And so Ron Schrader was the one who did it before me. He would leave at 10 minutes to 2, and he would get back about 5 to 3. Now, Reesburg isn't that big of a town that it would take you 45 minutes. You could walk from one end to the other in 45 minutes. I never understood what he was doing. So when they gave me the chance, I was out the door, down the street, in the bar, got the money, out, down to the grocery store. I left at 10 to 2. I was back by 10 after 2. And I come into bank, my tie's over my shoulder, I'm sweaty, you know. the president, Don Proper, says, "So Lyle," he said, "come in my office." I go in his office and he says, "So Lyle, you know, we don't want you running around town like you've just robbed a bar." And I said, "I'm not robbing the bar. I'm taking the checks back. You told me to take the checks back." He said, "Yeah, but we want you to walk. We don't want you to cross the street where there's no crosswalking. We want you to be a banker." And I said, "So that's what bankers do?" He said, "Yeah, we don't cross where there's red lights. We cross. We want people to trust us. They want to know we can." I said, "You know that you can trust me. I've been working here for 6 months." "Yeah, but it's the image, Lyle. You have to do the image." So I remember as he was telling me that, how disappointed I was that they were asking me to do things that didn't have any value to me. Mm. And so I'd go home and Dad'd say, "Would you help me get a load of hay in?" And we'd go out and get the biggest load of hay in the neighborhood. You know that? I was proud of that. So about 2 years down the road, I walked into his office, and the Proper's office, the president's office, and I told him, "In order for me to stay in that cage and keep cashing checks, I'm going to have to turn into a bird. And I'm not going to do that. So I'm out of here." And he says, "Oh, Lyle," he said, "we've invested almost 2 years in you." He said, "You're doing a really good job." He said, "I'll tell you what, you take 2 weeks off, and I want you to just take it off. We'll pay you. I want you to go buy a car, get rid of your 57 Ford." They had a 1962 Mercury Montego, which was a four-door they wanted me to buy. Uh-huh. That wasn't going to happen. And so he said, "Buy a car, buy a house, and we'll fund it for you. Just buy it." And he said, "And then go buy a diamond and marry this woman named Lori." And I said, "Okay." So I go out and I look for cars. And he said, "Oh, by the way, Lyle, you'll have to go to the Chevy dealer because they're one of our customers. And then Gavin's, they're the ones that have their account with us, so they'll sell you the house. And then you go here to this diamond store, I forget the name of it now, but they're a client of ours, so buy them from there." So I go up to the Chevy dealer, and there's a really bright yellow Corvette in there. And so they called up and told the people I was coming. So I walk in, and he says, "So Lyle, what kind of car do you want?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, as a banker," he said, "this is the kind of car you should have." And he shows me this yellow Corvette. So I sat in that yellow Corvette, and it's hard to describe, but it didn't feel like other people would think I should be in that car. And so my self-esteem just wouldn't let me buy that car. And I looked out the window and I saw that my 57 Ford, and I pictured it crying, you know. I really had that car fixed up nice. It had glass packs on it, and I mean, it had all the things you would want on a car, but not for a banker. So I said, "Okay, I'm not going to buy it." I left. And went to look at houses. They had this one house they wanted to show me. It's a banker's house. It was on the corner of a block, so you'd walk into the angle from the point, and you'd walk into this huge house. And I said to him, I said, "You know, this house is a little big. It'll just be Lori and I." And he said, "Well, that's what bankers do. They buy big houses, and they fix them up, and they sell them." And I said, "Well, I'm done with construction. I don't want to do construction. I was just going to be a banker." I said, "Well, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to do it." And so I went to the diamond store to buy a diamond. And I looked at the diamonds. I go, "What am I doing?" So I took off and I went down to see Lori. She lived in Madison. And as I drove in, she said to me, "What are you doing? Aren't you supposed to be at work?" And I said, "I am. But," I said, "I'm having a little trouble being a banker." And she sat down in a chair and she started to cry. And she said, "You know, Lyle, you don't see yourself as a banker. I don't think you see yourself as my husband. I don't think you see yourself as a dad. I think you see yourself as a farmer, as just a mason. And everything else is just something in your life." She said, "I just kind of was always afraid. We've been going together for 2 years. I said to her, "What are you talking about? You know, I'm all excited about this relationship." She said, "Yeah, but you're locked into your dad's thinking, and you're not ever going to get away from the farm." So I drove away, and I was driving up the interstate to go back to Reefsburg. I was crying up going up the interstate. I just couldn't understand why she didn't see me as a good guy. So I get into town, and as I get into town, I go in, and the bank was still open. And I walk in and walk to the president's office, and I held up all four fingers except for three of them. And I said to him, "I'm done. You just want to leverage me into debt forever, so I'll be a banker, and I'm done." And I walked out the door. So I sabotaged my opportunity as a banker, I sabotaged it because I didn't have a way to get in between a farm boy and a banker. And I know from all the clients that I talk to that there are people who are in a relationship now and they weren't, and how they're going to process what that relationship will look like if they don't have a process to get from A to B, that period of in between. If you're taking, you're leaving college and you're going to a job, mm-hmm. the college life and an employee's life as a company person, you have to process in between. I just was talking to a young guy who's 21 years old. He's going to be making $62,000, and he left college, all straight A's, really nice college. And he's having a difficult time processing from being a college student, raising hell, drinking, and having privilege mm-hmm. to being an employee, getting there on time, you know. And so it's really interesting how often we are in between and how we don't build a relationship with our brain and coach our brain into the new paradigm that we're going to be moving into.
Right. We have no idea how to do that.
We don't have any idea. And people don't realize that they have to talk to us and help us do that if they want us to work good for them. We want us to be a good employee. If I'm in a relationship, we better talk about how we're going to process from being single to a relationship. And what does that look like? What do you expect of me, and what do I expect of you? Most of the people, I've done a lot of work in domestic abuse. Many of the people I talk to, when I ask them, when did a relationship start? And nobody can ever identify that moment. So for me, a relationship would start when you sit down and start talking about what would our relationship be like? What do we want it to be? Mm-hmm. That's when the relationship starts. Otherwise, it's just a testosterone, estrogen climax, and then they go, how the hell did I get in this mess?
Well, that's so true. I am always amazed when I hear about people who are married for a period of time, and they still haven't discussed if they want kids or not. Or are surprised when one just assumed they were going to have kids and the other was like, well, wait a minute, we never talked about that. You know, like, how do you get that far, you know, to do that? But I think you're right. I think there's a lot of, yeah, I can think of many people where you just, like, you find yourself. I mean, I'm probably guilty of it myself, that you just find yourself sort of here. And then what? Like, how do you then go, okay, wait a minute. What are we doing here, and how do we do this, and how do we go forward, right? I mean, yeah. Think about the people who got married when they realized 2 days before the wedding that they really, really, really didn't want to, but they don't have that, not only permission, but even the know-how of how in the world do I change this whole trajectory I'm on?
That's right. And it happens day by day, and identifying it and then practicing it. It does not happen as an event. If you think it's going to be, if you're going to get in a relationship and it's going to work, your brain's got a different idea. Okay, so I left the bank, mm-hmm. and then my mom and dad was really happy because he thought I was going to go back in business with him. My mom talked me into going to college, and so I was in between being a farm boy, being a banker, and being a college student. And I went to Platteville, Wisconsin, and I didn't know what I wanted to major in, but I knew I wanted to be in the social sciences. And I got a scholarship to wrestle. That's how I got there. So they had me wrestle, and I had to wrestle the same kid I wrestled in high school to get on the team, because he'd been doing it now for 2.5 years, you know. So I wrestled him, and I tied him 5-5. And coach says to me, so Lyle, if you want to be on the team, you got to beat this guy. And he starts to tell me what all I have to do, and I said to him, you know, I know what it's like to work hard to be a champion. And I tell you, when I'm done, I don't want to just be a wrestling champion. I want to do something else. And man, this coach went off on me like you wouldn't believe, because I turned him down the year before when he gave me a scholarship 2 years ago. And so he was really angry at me, and he was yelling at me, and I'm thinking, I just think I'll just get up and walk out, you know? So I get up and walk out. As I'm walking out, I realize that I'm done with college now. So I'm walking back to my car, to my apartment and to my car, and as I'm walking back, I go through the student center, and just as I'm going to open the door, this little really skinny, probably middle-aged, I don't know how old he was then, but He had his haircut like they put a pan over his head, you know. And he says to me, "How are you today?" And I said to him, "Do you really want to know how I am?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm really confused. I don't know what I want to do with my life." And he says, "So why don't you come to one of my classes? It'll be in that building over there." And he pointed up on the third floor. "You go over there, be there at 1 o'clock today. You got time to do it, right? You're on your way home. Take another hour and come to my class." So I said, "Okay." So I go to the class at 1 o'clock. And as I'm walking, now you've got to remember, I have short hair, suntan, you know, everything that you would not see in the classroom I'm going to walk into. I get there, and I walk in, and man, these guys have long hair, and the women have hair on their arms, and under their arms, and they're dressed in really sloppy dresses. And I go, "This can't be where he wants me to be." So I back out. As I back out, he's coming in, and he says, "So I see you found it." He says, "Come on in." And I said, "You want me to go in there?" He said, "It's going to be okay, Lyle. Just come on in." So I go in, and I sat way in the back of the room, and everybody else is sitting up front like it's exciting. So I get set down. His name is Dr. Ellsworth Hood, and he was, I think he just retired from Platteville, but he's a really, really great guy. He says, "So, class," he said, there's a visitor in class today. His name, what is your name?" I said, "Lyle Wiles." He said, "He's trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life." And everybody in the room laughs. And he says, "So, Lyle, this is a philosophy class." And I don't even know what philosophy means, you know. So, so the professor starts talking about Plato and about the allegory of the cave and about opinion, true opinion, and knowledge and wisdom. And he said, "So how do we know what we know is true?" And when he asked that question, I just stood up and said, "Yes, this is where I want to be the rest of my life." And everybody turned around and looked at me and laughed. And then one girl goes, "Professor, we got another one." And so when class was over, the professor took me to the student center and set me down and asked me what I had come out of. And I told him that I had come out of a very fundamental religious family. I went from a Wesleyan Methodist to Evangelical United Brethren, then to United Brethren, then to Methodist, and then to United Methodist. I said, every time the name changed, the procedures changed. Mm. And I go, "So I don't know what's really what I should do." And he said, "Well, I want you to come and see me in my house once a week." And he said, I want you to be real careful about what you're thinking about, because I've seen people take these classes and really not be able to handle it. And it was my first experience of him taking care of me and coaching me from a very confused young man to a very confused philosopher. And a safe person in the community, you know. And so he did that with me for all the time I was at Platteville. And or it was about 2 months before my graduation. I had worked my way through college as a refrigeration repairman. And Bob Wagon Appliances in Platteville is where I worked. And so Bob had asked me to make a delivery for him. So I took a delivery, and it was like the end of the semester, and we're going to start the last one. And I was coming back, and I was in a hurry, and I hit some ice, and I hit a bridge going 60 miles an hour, and I just shattered my skull. And I drove my four front teeth right into the steering wheel. I didn't have my seatbelt on. So I shattered my forehead. I broke both eye sockets, both cheekbones, my jaw bones. And when they came to get me, they didn't even turn the lights on. They thought I would be dead at the scene. And a farmer picked me up, and I was knocked out, so he broke my teeth off, got me out of the car.
Oh, wow.
Took me to Hazel Green, where there was a little hospital. And I remember I was knocked out, so I remember laying on this bed, and he's got my left hand, and my wife's 4 months has got my right hand. And he puts my left hand on my chest as I'm waking up, and he said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Wiles, but your husband's gone." And I'm laying there, and I'm thinking, man, this seems like it's messed up. I don't know that I should be hearing him tell me I'm dead. And so I squeezed my wife's right hand, her hand, and she says, "Doc, I think he's still alive. He just squeezed my hand." So Doc thought I was dead. And whenever you think something's true, you filter out everything that's in conflict with that. And he said, "No, those are just death spasms." And I'm thinking, I'm going to die of negligence because I can't talk. My face is just smashed. And I'm losing my ability to get my breath because my blood is coagulating in my throat. So somehow or another, I passed back out, and she got the doc to do my pulse again. They put me to the hospital in Dubuque, Iowa, the Mercy Hospital. And I was out there for about 7.5 days. And when I came back, they asked me, so who's your mom, who's your dad, when's your birthday? All my appendages worked. I just had a really bad headache. And so when they asked me those questions, they didn't do an MRI because that was back in the 70s, you know. And so they said to each other, I remember him saying, well, it seems that his brain is okay. He processed the past perfect, brought it up to the present. So they assumed that I would bring the future in and process it through the same neurological landscape that I had before the accident. And they were totally wrong. When I was able to go home, on the way home, when I got home, I said to my wife, I said, so I'm just trying to figure out, why is it that we got married again? She said, because we love each other. And I said, you know, Glenda, I don't even like you. I don't want to be around you. She starts crying, and it's just a mess. So she calls her mom calls my mom calls me, and asks what's going on. And so we had a little conversation, and the bottom line to it was that my mom told me that she was going to disown me if I divorced Glenda. And I said, well, that's just fine, because I'm going to disown you too. And I went to Madison at the age of 21 and had a vasectomy so they could never have any grandkids. And then I went on a 20-year spree, and I did just what I wanted, when I wanted, as much as I wanted. And I ultimately became a chemist and manufactured cocaine. And I know that there's people on the face of this earth whose lives are probably hell because of me. And there's nothing I can do about that. And I feel really bad about it, but while I was making cocaine, I was in a relationship with a woman named Nancy. And so when you have a really nice lifestyle and you're stronger than the person that you're in a relationship with, she didn't always do what I wanted her to do, so I would beat her until she would submit to doing it. And she got tired of it. She called the cops. The cops came, and as they were driving up the driveway, she says to me, either you move out tonight or I'm taking them to your lab. And I said, you aren't going to do anything. So two cops come to the door, and she said, gentlemen, I got something I want to show you. So she took them to the lab. And I did move out that night. I just didn't get the apartment that I wanted. So I was put in jail. I was arrested, and the state picked me up and took me to trial, and because they didn't realize what they had busted, they couldn't prosecute me as hard as they wanted to, so they gave me 4 years, charged me with attempting to manufacture controlled substance. And when I got out, the feds picked me up and put me to trial and gave me 22 years more. So when you're 43 years old and you're headed for the feds for 22 years, you walk in and sit down on your bunk and you go, so now let me see, just how did a well-educated, well-connected white dude end up in federal prison for 22 years? I don't see a lot of other people in here with that kind of time. And so I realized that my community doesn't like the way my brain works, and they're going to put me in a box, put me in a cage, turn the lights on, turn the lights off, do whatever they need to do, because they don't trust me. Mm-hmm. And so one of the staff in federal prison asked me, because of my education, if I wanted to create a class that would repel the negativism of incarceration. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And so I was doing it just because I didn't have anything else to do. And some of the guys started to come up to me and said, you know, Lyle, stuff you're telling us, it really works. I really feel better about my life. And I go, what are you talking about? And so I thought, well, maybe I should try it. And so I started to try it, and life was getting a lot better. And so I set a goal to read 50 pages every day of my life while I was in prison. So I was in prison 585,792,410 seconds. Oof. So if you go 1,001, 1,002, we won't get there by the time we're done with this interview.
No, not quite.
So anyhow, And so I really studied, I read all I could get my hands on in philosophy, neurology, and sociology. And I started to read articles, and I noticed all of the brain damage that was being researched by the University of Wisconsin Neurological Research Center, Michael Koenig and Anthony Damasio. And I said, I bet I had it. And so I can tell you that I didn't give a damn about anything or anybody when I went to prison. If I would have been able to stay out and stay, I would have either killed Nancy or I would have killed somebody. It just was, I was not connected to anything. You can't sell drugs to pregnant women, children, girls that you really respected and just watch them go downhill and be connected to that community and sell drugs. It's just, you can't do that if you have any compassion.
So that damage that allowed you to do that and to walk out of the hospital and basically say, I don't even like you.
Yep.
Was the physical damage that happened after the accident.
Yep.
So when you're talking about these shifts you made while you were in prison and you were helping other people make and discovering, yep, that was sort of you kind of bringing your brain back online, understanding how it worked and understanding the damage and how do I shift this back to be the person that I want to be and even to be able to examine what kind of person you want to be.
Yep. And so it was starting to read the articles about brain damage and how the consistencies they talked about to people like soldiers, gang members who have been really beat up bad, football players, how they would have this feeling that they just couldn't care about people. Mm. And they were finding that with their research that they were able to readjust and reconstruct the brain with brain exercises, and that the people would actually start to talk about how they started to care about things, you know? And when you start to care about yourself, then you start to do things about yourself, and things start to change, and then that's a self-perpetuating process. So one of the things that was really powerful for me was I knew that I had to reframe the world that I was living in. I mean, if you want to go to prison and you're going to do 20 years in prison, you could say it's a waste of time. Or you can say, this is a sabbatical that I have a really good opportunity. Nobody can get in here to bother me. And no light bill, no phone bill. You know, I can just sit here and read. They give me my clothes, they feed me, and they just leave me alone if I don't do anything but read. And I can start to see the difference in me, and I can start to feel the difference in me. So the thing that really struck my attention was while I was in prison was there were people who would leave and there were people who would leave and never come back. So people who left and came back, people who left and never came back, I talked to the people who left and came back. And so they would tell me why they came back. They were always a victim. I got associated with this girl, she was on drugs, And so I started to say to myself, well, now I know what not to do, but I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so I started to track all the people who took my class. I taught it to like 1,000 people that took my class. And I followed them. I wrote to about 460 of them, 466 of them to be exact. I wrote to them and said, so if you're not coming back, what changed?
Tune in again next week when you'll get to hear more about Lyle's story and discover what the difference is between the men who left prison and came back and the men who left prison and never returned. This could be a very heavy subject, and I'm really grateful for Lyle and his sense of humor about it all. Next week, Lyle will talk a little bit more about what he does, but he does work with individuals, with groups. He speaks at various companies and works with them in various ways, looking at values and that kind of thing. So if you would like to learn more about Lyle, you can contact him through his website, which is wildsbraincoach.com. That's spelled WILDES, braincoach.com. And his phone number is 218-260-8601. Again, that's 218-260-8601. As you may recall at the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned that we would talk about a thing, quote unquote, thing, air quotes, that we're doing. And I wanted to share a little bit of that with you right now. So each week I talk about ways you can support the podcast. One of them, of course, is sharing the podcast. Another is if you're an Amazon shopper, go to my website, the podcast website, click on an Amazon anything, and then whatever you buy in that shopping trip, a little bit gets put into our little Wellness Renaissance Fund. The other thing is when I talk about becoming a patron. And when you go to the website, the wellnessrenpodcast.com website, there's a big red button on the left that says become a patron. And that is another vehicle, a financial vehicle to support the podcast. There are multiple levels. So there is $1 a month that you can sign up for. There are levels that include advertising of various types, a meetup. Well, what we're offering is a little bribe. That is, no matter what level you sign up for, I am offering to, in a gesture of gratitude, take you out for coffee, tea, some type of beverage, and conversation. Included will be a little surprise gift. And we can hang out for a little bit and we can conversate about whatever you want. If you want to talk about health stuff, that's groovy. If you want to talk about podcast stuff, that's groovy. If you want to talk about your dog or this great book that you read that nobody cares about and you want me to hear about it, fine. Let's do it. I am all ears and I'm excited to be ears. So this is a great chance for me to get to meet you and again, maybe look at pictures of your kids. I do love puppies and kitties and monkeys and elephants and dolphins. So if you have any of those pet pictures lying around, bring them on because I'm very excited to see them. And I'm fully aware that not very many people have a pet dolphin and you probably really shouldn't have a pet dolphin. But I did donate money to some cause once to adopt a dolphin and a dolphin's name was Bolshoi. That would be big in Russian. That's about the only word in Russian I probably know. But it was very delightful and I got a wonderful little postcard and I'm sure that so many people got the same postcard with the same dolphin. I have no idea. I don't know anybody else who tried to adopt a dolphin. This is what happens when you live with your parents and they don't let you have pets. On that note, head on over to the wellnessrenpodcast.com site. And of course, look at all of the wonderful podcasts that are out there with some just fantastic guests. And if you feel so called, check out that button on the left. Click, decide what level you want to jump in at, and I will get a hold of you and we will have coffee, tea, something like that. And if you are listening to this and you are not around the Duluth, Minnesota area and you're out of wherever I can get to, that's just fine. We will find a way to make it happen through Skype, FaceTime, some funky web thing that has been brought into our lives, giving us amazing opportunities. So thank you for listening and supporting the podcast and sharing the podcast. That is how this information gets out to people who need it. And that, quite honestly, is the goal. Again, wellnessren, R-E-N, podcast.com. You can join the email list there too, where we just shoot you a quick email each week, tell you what the title, how to get to the podcast, what it's about. You can click on that, click play, and poof, you're off and running. Lots of poofs in this episode. Have a wonderful week when we'll hear more from Lyle. Take good care of yourself. This is a busy time for many people with the holidays and all the things going on. So make sure that you eat some actual food that has grown at some point from the ground. Have yourself a delicious and nourishing meal now and then if you do have one of those crazy busy schedules. And for your own sanity, I hope that you don't. Keep moving physically more than just up and down the aisles of your local store. And remember, just to steal a little bit from Kim with Living Simply with Kim, experiences make fantastic gifts. So think about that. If shopping at the store can be a stressful adventure for many folks, there are other options that can mean wonderful and great things for people and family members and might be something they wouldn't normally think to do for themselves. So Kim will be a guest coming up towards or in January. So look forward to that. Until next week, may you continue to find the pieces that fit into your health and wellness puzzle. Be safe and be well.